Dear students, we have reached the heart of the course, common stock valuation. Yeah, all the stuff in Chapter 5 is really important. You really need to go back and study. I know some of it's very dry, but you need to know that. But here, we take one step further. We begin our investigation into how to value stocks. What are they worth? And what we're going to find is this ain't easy, folks. But listen to Greg Ireland, a mutual fund manager with over 35, almost 40 years of experience. Value matters. You ignore value at your peril. And he's right. Slide number 2. Stock valuation. Stock valuation is the process by which the underlying value of a stock is established on the basis of its forecasted risk and return performance. At any given time, the price of a share of common stock depends upon investors' expectations about the future behavior of the security. It's all about what people believe is going to happen in the future. And a fundamental assertion of finance holds that the value of a stock is based on the present value of its future cash flows, which you could think of the future cash flows as earnings, and you can also think of them as dividends, but some companies don't pay dividends. But the worth of a company is primarily based on the earnings the company will produce in the future. But if we knew what was going to happen in the future, it would not be called the future, would it? Exactly. As you might have heard this saying, it's attributed to many different people, but prediction is difficult, especially about the future. Yeah. Slide number 2. This is from A Random Walk Down Wall Street, and we've quoted from this book before. It's a good book, and it's one of the books you want to eventually read. The most fundamental influence on stock prices is the level and duration of the future growth of earnings and, consequently, dividends. However, future earnings growth is not easily estimated, even by market professionals. So if somebody were to ask you, what is the most important factor in determining the future value of a company? In a few words, you could say future earnings, or you could say future dividends. In other words, the person says, well, what's the company worth anyway? You say, what's it going to earn in the future? But do any of us know what is going to happen in the future? No. So is valuing stock going to be easy? No. No, it's downright difficult. Slide number 4. Security analysis is the process of gathering and organizing information and using it to determine the value of a share of common stock. And what we're after is the intrinsic value, the underlying value, the inherent value of a stock as determined through security analysis. But the question is, what security analysis methods or measures does one use to determine the intrinsic value of a company? There are many. Future dividends, potential capital appreciation, price-to-earnings ratio, financial ratios, past price performance, amount of risk, volatility. Value is in the eye of the beholder. And there's a saying that doesn't quite translate into English very well, a German saying, that is what makes horse races. I know it doesn't translate well, but the idea is, everybody's using different ways to value a stock, and that's what makes more markets. The fact that everybody says, yeah, buy, or says, best sell, or, you know, some people say buy, some people say sell, some people say hold, and that's what makes the market. That's what makes the horse race. Slide number 4, fundamental analysis. We're going to spend this chapter and the next discussing different types of fundamental analyses. There's another type of analysis that we're going to take a look at later on called technical analysis that's very different. But fundamental analysis is the examination of a firm's accounting statements and other financial and economic information to assess the economic value of a company's stock. Some of the examples of some of the fundamentals are the competitive position of the company, the growth prospects for the company and its market, profit margins, company earnings, what assets are available, the company's capital structure, how much debt, how much equity. Simply put, in fundamental analysis, the value of a stock is influenced by the performance of the company that issued the stock. How much are they going to earn? What are they going to pay in dividends? And as we'll see, there's another type of analysis that just throws all this stuff out the window and looks at squiggles on a screen. Later. Slide number 6. Financial ratio analysis is the first type of analysis we will do. And it's also easy. It's pretty easy. It's pretty straightforward. One method of security analysis involves looking at certain financial ratio measures. Financial ratios give us a quick and easy method for comparing one company to other companies within their industry or the stock market as a whole. The problem we find with financial ratios is that there is no one single financial ratio that can adequately sum up or summarize the overall general state of affairs, the situation, the predicament, etc., that a company finds itself in. You have to look at all the ratios. You'll find that many people just look at the one, the price-to-earnings ratio is the most popular, but there are many ratios, and we will look at those. The first ones we will investigate are the price ratios, and then in the next section, we'll discuss the others. So, slide number 7. The most popular stock market statistic is the price-to-earnings ratio. And we took a quick look at it in chapter 5, and we're going to look at it again in more detail because it is very important and it's subtle, folks. It's also called PE. You'll hear people say, what's the PE? And it's written P/E or P or PE. And it's a very simple calculation. You take the current price, the market price, and you divide it by the earnings per share. Historically, PE ratios were 5 to 12 for mature companies, 14 to 20 for growing companies. And historically, except during certain periods of time, late 20s, 1920s, late 60s, greater than 20 was unusual. In the 1990s, 100 was commonplace. Now PE ratios are pretty all over the map, but many of them are pretty high by historical standards, and we've made mention of this. Some people believe the market's ready for a tumble. I don't know. We're going to have a downturn. We know that. There's been many years without one, so we know we're going to have it. How bad it's going to be, I don't know. But I don't think they're way out of whack like they were in the late 1990s. So here's a few companies, actually four, and really all they have in common is they start with the same letter G, and that's why I picked them. But no, I picked them because of the different PEs that we're going to see. Let's take a look at GE, General Electric, a PE of 16.8, which is actually, not too high by today's standards. That's about average. So investors are figuring that, GE's prospects aren't great, but they're not horrible. And you compare that with General Motors, which has gone through some serious rough times, through bankruptcy during the Great Recession, and now is actually seems to be coming back, some of their problems notwithstanding, but they're doing actually fairly well in China. 22.8. Yeah, it's pretty high, folks. 22.8 is pretty high, especially for a car manufacturer. If we have a recession, we know we're going to have a recession someday, but it doesn't look like we're going to have one anytime soon. But if there were a recession, automakers get destroyed, and so that PE is going to fall like crazy. And then Google, a company you expect, a high-flying tech company, it has 25.8, and that's pretty high, but it's a lot lower than it was several years ago when Google was really flying high. And then GoPro, one of these high-flying companies just issue just went public, initial public offering. It's probably overpriced, imaginary profits only. And their PE we find to be 48.9, which is nosebleed. But it's not as much as Farsbook. I mean, Fleecebook. Facebook! And it's not as much as some of these other high-flying companies. But what we do notice is that there are fewer and fewer companies with PEs of 10 and 12, which just a few years ago there were many. So, take that for what it's worth. In other words, get prepared because we're probably going to have a downturn. I don't know when it's going to be, but it's going to happen. Slide number 8. Historically, a PE ratio of a company was supposed to match its growth rate. If a company was growing at 20% per year, then a PE of 20 was justified. But during the internet bubble, many companies had PE ratios in the hundreds. I'll never forget until my dying breath, looking down at the Quotron machine. You don't know what they are, but before the internet. It was during the internet still, but they were being phased out. Looking down at the Quotron machine and seeing a PE of 10,000 for eBay. And I just said to myself, you know, this ain't, this is not going to continue. It's just not going to continue. Remember our discussion of growth versus value? Growth stocks typically have high PE ratios and value stocks typically have low PE ratios, but that doesn't mean that a high PE ratio company is necessarily a bad value, and it doesn't mean a low PE ratio company is necessarily a good value. The PE ratio tells you how long it will take in years, assuming no changes in earnings, for the company to earn back its price. Now, that number, some people say, well, that's important. That's not that important. But think about it, folks. A PE of 3, the company's only going to take 3 years to earn back its price. Whereas a PE of 20, it's going to take 20 years. A PE of 10,000 years. And, of course, it didn't last. eBay fell about 90%, but survived. Amazon survived, but many of the high-flying internet companies are gone, and that's why you hear people talk about the NASDAQ hitting 5,000 again. It last hit 5,000 at the height of the mania in March of 2000, and then dropped to 1,200, 80%. Yeah, but it's come back, but it's not the same. It's not the same. You know, these companies are all different. There was no Farsbook or Twitter. No, Twitter is actually on the New York Stock Exchange. There was no GoPro or Google, and Apple was worth very little at the time, even though it was in the Nasdaq. Apple made its meteoric rise in the years 2000s up to today. So don't get caught in that trap of saying, okay, it's a high PE company, so it's a growth company, it's a low PE company, so it's a value company. No, watch those terms, growth and value. So how do we make money, right? How are we going to we're going to look at this? Well, we're also going to, I'm sorry, getting ahead of myself. Price to cash flow. Price to cash flow, slide number 9. Price to cash flow is the same idea as price to earnings, except instead of using earnings, we use cash flow. Well, wait a minute. What's the difference between earnings and cash flow, Pliano? Well, you accountants know that they are very different. Cash flow often differs from earnings per share for several reasons. But one major reason is depreciation. You accounting majors, you know what you did when you created income statements. You were able to reduce a company's earnings by subtracting depreciation from the earnings. Now, depreciation is not an actual cash expenditure. The company doesn't write a check to depreciation and money come out of their checking account. It's an accounting entry that allows you to pay fewer taxes because you reduce your earnings. And what you will hear people talk about is good quality earnings versus poor quality earnings. What? I don't understand. Hang on a minute. During the internet mania, many companies were reporting record earnings. But at the same time, the cash flow is negative. Wait a minute, that doesn't make any sense. How could you be making record earnings and your checkbook is going down? That doesn't make any sense. How could that be? Well, one perfect example is Lucent Technologies. And you probably never heard of them, but they make the best telephone equipment in the world. They used to be part of AT&T. They used to be called the Western Electric Bell Labs. And they were spun off from AT&T, I forget when, early 90s. And they became their own company. And they were a high-flying company. Why? Because so many of these startup companies needed internet technology and telephone technology. And Lucent Technologies was selling equipment hand over fist. They couldn't get out the door fast enough. But these companies didn't have money. They were startups, and they couldn't go to the banks. The banks wouldn't touch them. So they went to Lucent Technologies. Hey, would you sell us $2 billion of equipment? And oh, by the way, we'll pay you $100 million a year for the next 30 years because we don't have any cash. You see what happened? Lucent Technologies said, fush on, fine, we'll sell you $2 billion of equipment, pay us over the next 30 years, and 2 years later, the company's gone, and Lucent Technologies gets the equipment back, but they don't want it. It's worthless for them now. I mean, it's obsolete. It's 2 years old. Yeah, and Lucent Technologies almost went bankrupt. So you have to look at the quality of the earnings. Yeah, and that's where the accountants, we'll get into this more in detail in the next chapter. That's where the accountants have it over the rest of us, because they can dig deep into those financial statements. Slide number 10 is the same idea, but instead of using price to earnings or price to cash flow, we use price to sales. The current price divided by annual sales per share, as opposed to earnings, as opposed to cash flow. And historically, a higher price-to-sales ratio suggested a higher sales growth rate, and a lower price-to-sales ratio suggested a lower sales growth rate. Now, it's a very simple calculation. You take the price of the stock and divide it by the annual sales per share. And during the internet mania, many analysts were using price-to-sales instead of price-to-earnings, since most all the new companies never generated any earnings and would not generate any earnings for several years. And it said right there in their annual reports and their quarterly reports, we don't expect to make money for 5 or 6 years. But people thought that was no problem because everything was going to keep going the way it did until it didn't. And then the stock prices collapsed and the company disappeared and yeah. Anyway, now let me ask. Okay, one more slide. Price to book ratio. Exactly the same idea. You take the price and divide it by the book value per share. Now, the book value per share is another accounting entry that the accountants put together. And it's one of the things I ask you to look up in the Chapter 5 assignment, if you have done that already. Historically, if the price-to-book ratio was greater than 1, then shareholders believed the firm was creating value above and beyond the physical assets of the corporation. Well, that makes sense. If you look at the price and it's higher than the book value per share, then this ratio is going to be greater than 1. Well, you know, it's rarely close to the price of the stock. Why? And when you think about it, it makes perfect sense. A company is worth more intact than the value of the assets on the book. Think of a pizza shop or a shoe shop. I mean, how much are they worth, really? I mean, the pizza shop, it's got all the pots and pans and the door fixtures and the like, and maybe the pizza oven is really worth a lot. But the company itself is worth more intact. And before, people were really, really worried about companies. They just thought they were, and, you know, some people still do. So you didn't want to get the book value, the price of the stock get that high above the book value. But once people realize it, wait a minute, no, you don't understand. I mean, this company is worth far more intact, making money, than they are if you just sold off all the assets, paid off all the debts, and walked away. So now, it's typically 3 to 4 times more, sometimes more. At the bottom of the Great Recession in early 2009, it hit about 1.8 or so, so it still never hit one. But some companies were priced below the book value. Yeah, when that happens, it's serious. When that's very serious. Okay, so make sure you understand these ratios, because now, slide number 12, dear students, we're going to try to make some money doing it. We're going to try to predict the future price using these price ratios. Price to earnings, price to cash flow, price to sales. And how do we do that? Well, on slide number 12, we multiply an historical price ratio by the expected future value price ratio denominator. What? Why did you say, Piano? It's harder to explain than it is to do. So let's do it and worry about the explanation afterwards. What we do is we take some numbers that they give us, or we go look up, or we calculate, and we throw them together, and bingo, we got an answer. From the sixth edition, we're looking at Intel Corporation. And in late 2009, the stock was selling for $19.40. Now remember, this is after the end of the world, right? This was after people thought the world was going to end. The earnings per share that year were 92 cents. And going back 5 years, the price to earnings ratio was $20.96. PE is unitless, folks. My apologies, no dollar sign. And then we expect, or the analyst told us, that the price was going to, earnings per share was going to go up 8.5%. So what we do is we take the historical PE ratio and we multiply it by the projected earnings per share. Huh? Well, think about it, folks. If we take the historical PE ratio, price to earnings, and then the earnings go up a certain amount, we should expect the stock to go up a certain amount. That's the reasoning. Now, whether or not it makes any sense at all, that's up, you decide. And how do we get the next year's earnings? Well, we take the current year's earnings and multiply them times 1 plus the expected growth rate. What? Well, think about it. 100% plus 8.5% is 108.5%. So look at the formula. The expected stock price is equal to the historical PE ratio times the projected earnings per share, but the projected earnings per share are equal to the current earnings per share times 1 plus what we expect the earnings to grow by, 8.5%. So plugging in the numbers, that's 20.96, that's the 5-year average PE, going back 5 years, times 92 cents, late 2009 earnings per share, times 1 plus 8.5%, 108%, 108.5% essentially, 1.085. If you don't understand that, please contact me, because it's easier to do the calculations to understand what you're doing. But if you do the calculations enough times, a few times, you'll go, oh, I understand. I'm taking that 5-year average, and I'm multiplying by what I think the earnings per share are going to be next year. And to me, that says, okay, the stock price should go up by that much. And so the formula, the model that we are using, says the stock should be $20.96. All right. Okay. Let's see what we got next. Next is the price to cash flow per share. And it turns out it's the exact same formula, but you just plug in the different numbers. You use the price to cash flow ratio the last 5 years, the current cash flow per share, and 1 plus the expected cash flow per share growth rate. So we go back 5 years from late 2009, and we see that the expected stock price was 10. The 5-year average price to cash flow ratio was 10.85. Now, where did we get that? You know, we can look it up or calculate it ourselves, and we'll discuss how we get that information later on. And we find that their cash flow per share for late 2009 is $1.74. Wait a minute, Payano. They earned 92 cents in 2009, and their cash flow is $1.74. This is very typical of companies like Intel. Why? Because they have tremendous capital expenditures. It costs them a couple $1 billion or $1 billion to make that first chip. And then it costs them $2 to make each next chip. So they have huge capital expenditures. That's the name we use. In other words, they got to spend a lot of money to make the first chip. And so they have to depreciate that. And they don't write out a check to depreciation. They have to make an accounting entry, which lowers their earnings. But that cash is still coming in the door. So many people say you should really look at the cash flow per share. You should look at both, obviously. But in this case, it was $1.74. And the analysts told us, or we believed, or Intel told us, that they expect their cash flow to grow by 7.5%. So plugging in the numbers again, we get 10.85, that's the 5-year average of the price to cash flow ratio, times the current cash flow, $1.74, times 1 plus 7.5%, 1.075, and that gives us $20.29. We expect the price in late 2010, 1 year later, to be $20.29, which is fairly close to the previous price to earnings estimate. See? It's easier to do than it is to understand. But if you do it enough times, you'll understand what you're doing. Slide number 14, price to sales, exact same methodology. The sales, you know, again, high sales because it costs them a lot of money to make these things. To make the first one, then it costs them almost nothing to make all the rest. $6.76 sales per share. The price to sales ratio over the last 5 years was 3.14. And the analysts or Intel or we believe that they're going to grow their sales next year by 7%. So we plug in the numbers, 3.14, the average 5-year average price to sales ratio, times $6.76 of sales in late 2009, times 1.07, and we get $22.71, which is a bit more optimistic, right, based on the sales. But still, positive. Okay. Now make sure you go back and do these again, and we have a worksheet that we're going to do, worksheet number one, and worksheet number two, and the assignment, and the excellent, and so you're going to do these several times, and you will, trust me, you will come to understand what you're doing, and if you don't worry about it, just plug in the numbers. Slide number 15, reality check! Reality check. Can we reasonably assume that the formulas on the previous slides will give us realistic figures? Well, for many companies, yeah, and for many companies, no. There are countless other factors at work. Folks, it's like trying to predict the weather, only worse. We don't have radar. The major assumption of these models is that the price multiples will remain constant. We're going back 5 years and taking an average. But we're taking the averages without taking into account the variances and the standard deviations of the averages. Remember them? How much the average in any 1 year varies from the average over, you know, 5 years. Is it reasonable to expect predictions from these models to be accurate if the variances of the averages are large? Well, for the record, slide number 16, the price of Intel 1 year later in late 2010 was around $20.50. Not bad! Yeah, well, 1 out of 4 ain't good, folks. The predictions for the 3rd, 4th, and 5th editions for the next year prices of Intel were far from the actual prices. The predictions in the third edition were $19.61, $27.54, and $31.63, and the actual price 1 year later was $33.50, so they were all too pessimistic. In the fourth edition, they were all too optimistic, because that's when the wheels started to fall off. And the fifth edition, they were also too optimistic. Notice that the third editions were too low, the fourth and the fifth editions predictions were too high. Gives you a lot of confidence in the price models, huh? No. Well, take heart. The predictions for Disney from the book were much closer to the actual prices. And you could ask why. And one answer may be that, look, Intel is a very high-tech company, and high-tech is volatile to begin with. And Disney, on the other hand, is a much more staid company that's been around for, you know, decades and has that core business. And then every once in a while they come out with a blockbuster, and bingo, they make a lot of money, or they come out with a stinker. Was it John Carter or something like that just lost a ton of money on? And Disney turns out to be an easier company to use these price models. One last note. These are at the back of Chapter 6. I put them up front because I think they're a little easier to do the calculations. Not quite as tricky. Because, dear students, in the next presentation, we are going to show you a technique that is going to knock your socks off. Next two presentations. That is going to ring your chimes, that is going to warm the cockles of your heart, whatever phrase you want to use. But we are going to learn how to discount a future stream of income. Doesn't that sound exciting? Well, it is, as you'll see. So go back over, make sure you understand these, make sure you can do them, more importantly. They're the first three problems in worksheet number one, first three problems in worksheet number two, and the assignment sheet. And we will pick up with the dividend discount models in the next part of our presentation. See you in our second presentation for Chapter 6.